On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 33-year-old Monica Goodling was the screen at the Bush Justice Department. Word was you had to get by her to get in. When the lid came off, she took the fifth, then took immunity, testifying before Congress yesterday. And yes, she said, lines were crossed.
The best I can say is that I know I took political considerations into account on some occasions.
Was that legal?
Sir, I'm not able to answer that question. I know I crossed the line.
What line? Legal?
I crossed the line of the civil service rules.
If critics hoped Goodling would explicitly implicate Karl Rove in the White House, it didn't happen. But what Goodling had to say, in its way, was explosive. The attorney general lying under oath, she indicated. So did his number two. And yes, legal lines crossed at the heart of the American justice system. This hour On Point, litmus test, purges and perjury. Monica Goodling, the Justice Department, and the American way of government put to the test. Joining me first today from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal analyst for the online news magazine Slate. She was at the House Judiciary Committee hearing yesterday with Monica Goodling. Dahlia Lithwick, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Well, you had some fun writing this up. You say the members of Congress had some trouble with this very demure, soft-spoken, direct young Miss Goodling.
Well, you know, there have been sort of two parodies of Monica Goodling floating in the media for the last couple of months. One is this completely unhinged, weepy little girl, reports of her crying for 40 straight minutes when the scandal first broke and babbling about her boyfriend and gibbering about her lost job. So we sort of half expected that Monica to show up. Mm. And then the other is the one that you pointed to in your intro, Tom, when you said, you know, she was this sort of iron-fisted, lunatic, this religious zealot who, you know, was the person you wouldn't cross at the Justice Department, in charge of all hiring, firing, who was sort of systemically changing the face of the Justice Department. And we really didn't see either of those two parodies yesterday. We saw someone who was actually, I think, in her own way, very impressive, very assertive, very self-confident, incredibly articulate, quite funny at times. And it seemed, I think, you know, I described it as the sort of soft bigotry of low expectations. Mm. I think we expected her to be either such a zealot that she couldn't speak, or such a crybaby child that she couldn't, you know, breathe. And she was neither of those things. And it seemed as though both sides had a little trouble knowing how to handle her.
You describe her as a kind of Elle Wood from Legally Blonde showing up on the stand here. Apart from the theatrics, then, what did we actually learn? What were the big questions as she walked in here with immunity, and how much got answered?
Well, I think, you know, and you pointed this out in your opening remarks, what got answered was sort of around the margins. I mean, certainly she came right out the gate and copped to her own, that sort of crossing of lines. She said there's no question she violated the civil service laws. She did take politics and ideology into account when she was hiring career attorneys at the Justice Department. But she went out of her way to sort of distance herself from the U.S. attorney purge. She said she wasn't a key decision maker. She really put that on her former boss, Kyle Sampson. He would have been Alberto Gonzalez's chief of staff at the time. She went out of her way to say that Rove and Myers were not implicated. She said she certainly, as far as she knew, had no contact with them, although, bracket that by the fact that she did say there was significant White House sign-off on the plan, on the purge itself. So it was very, very tough. You sort of had to tease a lot out between the lines, and then I think she dropped a sort of bombshell right at the end of the day when she said that, in fact, right toward the end of her tenure at Justice, she was getting very stressed out. She wanted to leave. She went in to see Attorney General Gonzalez to ask for a transfer, and he tried to sort of align his testimony with hers, more or less, that he sort of wanted to check his version of what had happened in the purge against her version of what had happened, and that made her extremely uncomfortable. And then again, reading between the lines, it sounded like she said that when he testified last month that he hadn't talked to anyone at Justice about his testimony, that he had perjured himself because he'd clearly tried to talk to her.
So she's got immunity. Did you know, that means she can say, I crossed the line, and in a way, she's clear, right?
Right. Well, she has what's called use immunity. It's a narrow immunity. She's not immune for everything, but she is immune to the extent that what she testified to yesterday is immunized. And so I think it's probably not an accident that what she clearly did right out the gate is say, okay, here's what I did when I broke the civil service laws. You know, she essentially scuttled that whole investigation that's going on, the internal investigation. So she's certainly immunized for anything that she testified to. Now, there's, you know, there are larger questions of criminality, perhaps, that don't involve what she testified to yesterday. But yes, I think that was the quid pro quo.
So she's immunized, but what about the rest of the Justice Department crew here then? The pressure has been enormous on Alberto Gonzalez. Of course, a number of very high people already gone. But does this raise the heat on Gonzalez? Does it obfuscate? How do you see it?
You know, Tom, I've been trying to judge for months now. At Slate, we have something called a Gonzometer that's supposed to be measuring the likelihood of a, you know, Gonzalez departure. And it's been, you know, up to 90 and down to 70. And I no longer even try to speculate what could, you know, create pressure on Gonzalez, because it's clear that no metric known to man can measure when it's time for him to go. He's going to go when he wants to go, regardless of external pressure. But I do think that, as I said, what she said right at the very end, that he was clearly not honest in his initial statements, that he knew nothing about the purge, that he was not involved. Now, he's since rescinded those statements. But then that he was again not honest last month when he testified that he had not had conversations with any of his subordinates. She really, really did put it out there yesterday that he did have a conversation with her, and that, moreover, when she knew this conversation was happening, it made her uncomfortable. She knew they were going to have to testify to this at that point, and that he didn't seem to have any awareness that that was problematic. So I think she did ratchet up the heat on him. And my understanding is that was one of the reasons that she was granted immunity, that it was sort of, there was no formal proffer of what she was going to testify. But certainly her lawyer had said to the committee, she's got a little something on Gonzalez. And I think that little something probably turned out to be that conversation that he tried to have with her.
But you write, of course, in Slate, that if Congressman came expecting the great exploding idiot Barbie, they did not get what they came for, though a number of those things right there in black and white now. Two tracks here. One, the U.S. attorneys fired around the country and all the allegations around that, how politically driven that was, whether that was done in order to promote particular cases that people wanted brought against Democrats, or to punish people who didn't bring such cases against Democrats, and the other, career people inside the Justice Department held to the civil service, to the litmus test, apparently, she's saying, that may break civil service rules and therefore the law. On the first side of that, David Iglesias is one of those U.S. attorneys who was fired last fall as part of the famous 8 or 9, or however you want to count them. He joins us right now from Albuquerque, New Mexico. David Iglesias, thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom. Glad to be here.
So you no doubt watched Monica Goodling's testimony yesterday, heard it, have read what she said. She was tough on you, among others, kind of a dud, absentee landlord. What did you make of her performance or testimony?
Well, at least she's got a memory. At least she didn't say, I don't recall or I don't know 70 times like the AG did. The only thing new regarding my departure was the dud on the AGAC. That's the Attorney General's Advisory Committee that I served on. And I suspect she probably got that information from the only member of the AGAC that's still working at Maine Justice. That's Bill Mercer. And Mercer's the one that dimed me out as being the absentee landlord, which I find to be incredibly ironic, because Mercer is still the U.S. attorney for Montana, and he hasn't lived there in 2 years.
Now, you're a reserve U.S. Navy Judge Advocate General, JAG. You've said, yes, you were away doing your military duty, and that got turned into an absentee landlord charge against you?
Right, and no one at any time ever told me I was doing too much military duty, nor, you know, did they ever say there was a problem with me being gone too much. So I just find Mercer's comments and her comments to be the classic case of the pot calling the kettle black.
David Iglesias, as you've watched this over the last couple of months now, since it all came tumbling out, where's your bottom line? Do you see, you know, there have been very big allegations here that this is a kind of un-American purge, extreme politics, purge in the de-bathification, you know, sort of mold. Do you see American tradition gone off the rails here, or something more typical, business as usual?
No, I don't think it's business as usual. I've talked to people that have been with the Justice Department for 30 years, and none of them have ever seen anything remotely similar to this. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence pointing toward there being U.S. attorneys forced out for partisan political reasons, in particular Charlton in Arizona, Lamb in Southern California, McKay in Seattle, and me in New Mexico. We don't have the smoking gun email or memo. That may or may not be at the White House. But I have no doubt that what's going on right now is unprecedented.
Is it time for the Attorney General to resign? Is it time for someone to go to jail?
Regarding criminality, I hope when all the investigations are done by the Inspector General, by Office of Professional Responsibility, by the House and Senate, by Special Counsel, that there may be evidence of criminal laws being broken. I don't think we're there yet. Should the Attorney General resign? I've steadfastly not commented on that publicly, but I know he knows what the right thing to do is.
That's a comment within a no comment, I guess. David Iglesias in Albuquerque, New Mexico, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We're talking this hour about Monica Goodling, the Bush Justice Department, and the American way of government perhaps being put to the test here, about extreme politics, an urge to purge, as somebody said. Dahlia Lithwick of Slate was there watching the testimony yesterday of Monica Goodling, former counsel to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and liaison to the White House. New York's Gerald Nadler opened his questioning by getting Ms. Goodling to explain why exactly she had needed immunity from prosecution to testify before the committee.
Ms. Goodling, before you came here to testify, you asserted your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, and you were granted immunity.
Yes.
To assert Fifth Amendment privilege, you're in effect asserting that you're aware of crimes that may have been committed, and you're saying that you don't want to be implicated. What crimes are you aware of that you feared your testimony might be asked about?
I don't believe that I committed any crime.
I didn't ask if you committed. I said, what crimes were you aware of? What possible crimes are you aware of that caused you to be concerned enough to seek or to claim the Fifth Amendment?
I asserted the Fifth Amendment based on the fact that these were very ambiguous circumstances in which to testify, and I believed that the Deputy Attorney General had made an allegation that I had deliberately withheld information from him, and I believed that that was a concern, and I wanted.
Okay, so in other words, that his allegation might be construed by some as a crime was your concern.
That was the basis for.
Okay.
And there's New York Congressman Gerald Nadler with Monica Goodling yesterday before the House Judiciary Committee. Dahlia Lithwick of Slate is with us, and right now we're joined as well from Washington by Mark Tushnet, professor of law at Harvard University School of Law. Professor Tushnet, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I know you've been following the testimony again yesterday. It's not easy for people, you know, outside of this circle and not familiar with the law and politics as played here to know when we're really over the line and when we're not. But Monica Goodling says a line has been crossed. Have there been lines crossed here? If so, where? How significant? How profound in your view?
There are two things going on here that we now know of. One is the treatment of career attorneys. And she said that she had taken political considerations into account in hiring, she said, perhaps up to 50 career attorneys. Mm. That's a fairly large number. And with respect to career attorneys, that is, people who represent the government in ordinary litigation and the like, not only is it taking partisan considerations into account prohibited by the civil service laws, it's a very bad thing. We want those people to represent the government, to be above politics so that when a Republican administration replaces a Democratic one, they'll do their jobs no matter who's in charge. And it's a very bad thing to promote and hire on partisan grounds.
Is it a very new thing, Professor?
There's no question that sort of in the back of people's minds, you think, well, we're hiring somebody who, will this person do what we want the person to do? And you're likely to think, well, if this person's politically sympathetic, they'll probably be easier. At the same time, when you're hiring a career person, you know that person's going to be there in the next administration and for years afterwards. And so you don't want, and you shouldn't, say, we're going to hire this person who's going to be a mole for us in the next administration. We really don't want that to happen. And in general, it hasn't happened. Obviously, around the edges, yes, you know, some things happen. But I think it's unusual for people, I think it probably is unprecedented for somebody to explicitly ask who you voted for in the last election. She said she asked that question. Or to examine to whom these people made contributions, political contributions. I would be very surprised if that had happened before.
And at the heart of this, you're saying there's what? The potential there for the appearance of or the fact of a kind of corruption of justice by politics embedded in the Justice Department?
Well, I'm not sure corruption is the right word, but a distortion of the outcome of elections. Look, you take it outside the current situation. Suppose a Democrat said, I'm going to only hire Democrats as career attorneys, and then Republicans take over the Department of Justice. They win an election. They're entitled to change policy. But if they're facing partisan Democrats, people who have been selected because they were Democrats in the Department of Justice, they're not going to be able to do what the people said elected them to do. Now, you know, taking next year, suppose the Democrats win the election, there'll be a new Department of Justice headed by a Democratic Attorney General who will have different priorities from this one, and that's fine. And we want the Department of Justice to then do what the new administration wants done. If you have partisan Republicans as career attorneys, you'd be worried that they won't do what the administration and what the people of the United States want them to do.
Dahlia Lithwick, what about it then? Did the Bush administration come in and feel that it was sitting on top of a kind of carved-in stone civil service opposed to its policy changes? Or was this something beyond that? Karl Rove talked about, you know, the sort of endless Republican Party. Does this appear to have been an effort to build exactly what Mark Tushnet's describing there, a partisan civil service that would be immune to policy change if politics changed?
I don't think there's any question, excuse me, that that's what happened. And if you look at, for instance, what happened within the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department, someone like Joseph Rich, who was the head of the Civil Rights Division, who was at the department for years and years under Republican and Democratic presidents, who has been a fierce critic of what's gone on in the administration and under the sort of Goodling-Sampson regime. And he's the first person to say, look, you know, career attorneys are supposed to be, as Professor Tushnet says, you know, they're supposed to have some institutional memory and some institutional responsibility that transcends, you know, the ebbs and flows of this president. And so when you have career attorneys, for instance, saying this is an example of you know, Karl Rove's obsession with voter fraud, but saying, for instance, that the state of Georgia's proposed voter ID initiative is not appropriate, that it will suppress minority votes. You have career attorneys saying this doesn't work. We have an institutional memory. It's not a good idea. And that's overruled. That's what happens when you get rid of career attorneys. You get this sense of everything is up for grabs now.
And that is exactly the kind of thing that this country has criticized in other countries for a long time. And yet, there was real support for her in the room yesterday. I mean, Republicans and Democrats both have been very critical of many of the actions of political appointees at Justice in this administration. But yesterday, Mark, Dahlia, let's listen for a moment here to James Sensenbrenner, Republican from Wisconsin. Well, pretty friendly to Monica Goodling.
Isn't this an exercise of legitimate executive power, which practically every president up to including the current one exercises all the time with officials within the executive branch subject to his appointment?
I believe it is.
Now, you know, let me say that this committee has spent $250,000 of the taxpayers' money basically investigating the replacement of U.S. attorneys whose terms had expired.
I was the chairman of this committee for 6 years during the Bush administration and the chairman of the Science Committee for 4 years during the Clinton administration. I never signed a subpoena because I didn't have to, and I never asked my committee to request the Justice Department to obtain a grant of immunity to anybody. It seems to me that with this fishing expedition, there ain't no fish in the water, and we've spent an awful lot of time and an awful lot of money finding that out.
Mark Tushnet, there ain't no fish in the water, says James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin. What do you say to that?
Well, there, he's referring to the second issue that's raised. And I do want to stress on the career attorneys issue, mm-hmm. There's no question that something very bad happened. The only question is how extensive it was. Was it only Monica Goodling and these up to 50 people, or was it more important, more significant? What Representative Sensenbrenner is talking about is the dismissals of the U.S. attorneys. And they are presidential appointees, and everybody agrees that politics can be taken into account in dismissing U.S. attorneys. But the question is there, as Mr. Iglesias said, circumstantial evidence to worry that not politics, but efforts to improperly influence the course of justice took place. In Mr. Iglesias' case, the sort of circumstantial evidence is that there were people who were concerned that he was too slow in prosecuting Democratic political corruption.
He said he looked and it wasn't there, or he couldn't see the grounds for a case.
Well, his position was the investigation hadn't turned up enough evidence yet to warrant an indictment. Now, if he's dismissed because he says, I looked at the evidence and it's not there yet, that sends a signal to other prosecutors to say, you know, push the envelope on your evaluation of the evidence.
Whether you've got the goods or not, go for it. Push it.
Right. And it's not that politics affected the decision. It's that efforts to persuade people to bring indictments that on professional standard wouldn't be justified in order to influence elections might increase. Again, that's a bad thing, and it's not that common.
Let's turn to our callers for a moment. Francesca is calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. Francesca, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Actually, I'm in my car practically now in Springfield, and I've been having a little difficulty hearing what's been going on. But here's my question. Ms. Goodling actually wanted immunity because she felt that she was probably liable for some kind of prosecution. And I presume that some of that prosecution had to do with her confession yesterday that she crossed the line with the civil service laws and rules.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering now that she's made that admission, why is it that Attorney Gonzalez isn't going to be held accountable for those crimes, if you will, of his underling? He's in charge of the Department of Justice, and he's responsible for all of the acts of his underling.
Right, and she said straight up that she's crossed the line. Let us look at that. Mark Tushnet, how does responsibility go up the line here? If she concedes that, is there criminal culpability on the Attorney General's part, or just managerial responsibility, or any responsibility?
Well, there's clearly managerial responsibility. The criminal liability would depend on the extent to which it could be shown that he knew that she had been taking improper considerations into account in making these decisions. I think that, given his testimony about his lack of knowledge, recollection, it would be hard to make out a criminal case against him on the basis of what we now know. Maybe there's more rattling around that we don't know. But the criminal liability, if it would exist, would require a showing of his own awareness of the improper, that he did more than just sort of, as he said, rubber stamp what people presented to him.
Let's get another call here from Bluffton, South Carolina. Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing today?
We're all right. What do you see, Michael?
Well, here's the issue, and I've been following it pretty closely, is, I really believe this is unprecedented in the 200-year history of the country, that no president has gone into the middle of administration and let go attorney generals for, quote, cause. And I know there's been others, as I understand, the Clinton administration, where there's some credit card abuse, et cetera, where there's justifiable cause. And the reason is because it's tough to get new ones, because you have to get in front of the Senate and get them confirmed, et cetera. So I don't think that...
Well, it used to be tough, but the Patriot Act changed that, as Dolly Lukluk has told us before.
Mm-hmm. That's my point, and I'm sorry for crosstalking here, but my point is, you know, I don't think the evidence is circumstantial. I think the evidence, there's an email I remember floating around that says, if we don't take advantage of this Patriot Act, we'd be missing an opportunity here. So I remember that email floating around. So obviously somebody, whether it be the Justice Department or the White House, knew about this situation and said, let's take advantage of it, and tried, and they got their hands caught in the cookie jar. So why don't they just get up and say, and I know this administration is tough for them, they just get up and say, you know what, we made a mistake. Gonzalez is out. We're going to try to clean things up. But, you know, this is just a fault of this administration going forward. Nobody can get up and say, and I said, should say this with the Clinton administration, too. It was very difficult for him to come and say, yes, I messed up, and this is what we got to do to go forward.
Michael, we've got it. Dahlia, first to you. Unprecedented in 200 years of American history, Michael says, and it's time to fess up, take the rap. I mean, you've already said nobody knows what the Attorney General is going to do, but what about the claim that it's that unprecedented? We're all trying to figure out, do we have a crisis here, a real core abuse of the system, or something more tolerable?
I think, I mean, obviously there are shades of gray, and there's no question, as you know, the GOP's members of Congress pointed out yesterday, you know, these are always political appointments. They're always political considerations. You know, indeed, Bill Clinton came in and fired all 93 right when he came into office, as, by the way, did George Bush Sr. and Reagan before. I mean, this is not unprecedented. So we're talking about, questions of kind. But I think that Michael's really, really important point is that the key to this, to understanding this sort of plot or plan, is understanding that the reason to do this was that the Patriot Act had been changed. You could slide people into these interim positions, bypass confirmation, no judicial involvement anymore, no Senate confirmation anymore, and that was the point. And he's quite right to say that's why those emails were going around saying, this is the plot. We've done this. Let's get our folks in. It is no accident that one of the things that Goodling testified to yesterday was that one of the core things that former Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty, in her words, misled Congress about in his testimony, was the extent to which the White House was involved in getting Tim Griffin installed in Arkansas. They really wanted this Karl Rove protege in a spot where he would not face confirmation, and they wanted to do it quickly. So I think it's important to say, yes, you know, we have to step back and see this was a larger plan.
Let's hear a little bit more of the testimony yesterday. Here's Monica Goodling in an exchange with New York Democrat Gerald Nadler. Here she is, in effect, accusing former Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty of lying to Congress. McNulty tendered his resignation last week.
In effect, your testimony is that the Deputy Attorney General misinformed the Senate Judiciary in sworn testimony. Is that not correct?
I'm just saying that I didn't believe he was fully candid, and the point that I was trying to make is that I did give him some information. I didn't withhold information. I gave him a lot of information, and he had some of that information and didn't use all of it.
Although, in fact, he stated things directly contrary to what your written statement says he knew to be true.
Those would be conclusions for others to draw.
Okay. That's fair enough.
Not fully candid, she's suggesting there, in part about White House ties to the whole business. Dahlia Lithwick of Slate is with us. Mark Tushnet of Harvard Law School is here. And right now we're joined as well from Washington by E.J. Dion, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. E.J., thanks very much for being here.
Good to be with you.
We're trying to see what's going on inside our justice system, but we also want to be mindful of it in a kind of broader context here. There's been some very big guns pulled out in the last week. Tom Friedman in the New York Times saying this is the equivalent of a kind of debathification campaign, real, you know, purely partisan purge of the kind that the American government would have has criticized in many governments around the world over many years. How do you see what's going on here? Is it part of a broader picture? What do you see, EJ?
Well, you know, when I opened up my Washington Post this morning, there was a story, and I'll just read the lead. The U.S. Office of Special Counsel has found that the General Services Administration Chief, Loretta Alexis Doane, violated the Federal Hatch Act when she allegedly asked GSA political appointees during a January briefing how they could, quotes, help our candidates, close quotes, win the next election. And I think what you've seen in this administration is pushing things beyond the normal amount of politics that you're going to get in any Democratic government. Because as you've been saying, any Democratic government is going to have politics in it. Politics is okay.
Yeah.
But we've always had a balance between politics and professionalism, between the norms of a political campaign and the norms of running a government. And I think the reason this U.S. attorney scandal has not gone away and indeed keeps growing is because lots of people, not partisan Democrats, but lots of people have a deep instinct that when a prosecutor charges someone of a crime, they are threatening to deprive that person of their rights. And it's not a process in which you want politics to play an enormous role. You don't want prosecutors charging more Democrats than Republicans if they are Republicans, or more Republicans than Democrats if they're Democrats. And so that's why her testimony yesterday that she was checking into the partisanship of civil service type employees is genuinely troubling to a lot of people. And it's why a lot of Republicans have said that Attorney General Gonzalez should go.
Mark Tushnet, do you see a self-correcting system here, or have we now got a virus on the loose at justice that's hard to clean away?
We don't really know at this point how hard the, as you put it, virus is going to be to clean out. There is a certain amount of self-correction that occurs as a result of divided government. These things, were happening earlier in the administration, but when Republicans controlled the House and Senate, as Representative Sensenbrenner said, he didn't issue subpoenas because they were doing things that he didn't disagree with. Now you have Democrats in charge, and they're going to be doing oversight. It matters who wins elections to make sure that this government runs the way it ought to run.
But Dahlia, there was so much talk about a Republican revolution. Republicans clearly here wanted to change the overall complexion of the leadership of the country, of the government of the country, and its exercise of government. So I don't know. Maybe Republicans would say, what are we supposed to do? You've had an entrenched bureaucracy there with a different complexion from ours. We wanted that to change. What's so wrong about that?
Well, I think, Tom, that the answer to that is that you sort of triangulate from the truth and from facts. And one of the things that has been driving this that is so, so pernicious is this sort of weird, weird Republican snipe hunt over voter fraud. And, you know, what's so interesting is the extent to which this chasing, what I call ghost busting of vote fraud, you know, a phenomenon of which there is no evidence. They've yet to bring, after obsessing over this, one, vote fraud case to fruition. And yet this obsession has absolutely penetrated the way the Justice Department is run. You know, vote fraud has become the emphasis.
Surface a presumption here, Dahlia. Many people look at this and say this is a kind of aggressive, you call it ghost busting, but it's kind of aggressive campaign to scare voters away, even when there is no voter fraud there, to raise legal issues that will impede voters or the opposition party, even when there's no big evidence of it.
That's right. I mean, there's an important study out of Rutgers that shows that the effect of all these vote fraud initiatives is in fact not to get rid of vote fraud, which by the way doesn't exist, but to suppress minority and the turnout of minority and poor voters. I mean, that is the effect. And don't forget, what animates all this is this very, very closely fought 2000 election and this sort of sensibility that we don't know how to keep that from happening other than suppressing possibly votes for Democrats. And so it seems to me that at the heart of what's changed at Justice is that whole divisions, whole careers are devoted to this. And again, at least two of the fired U.S. attorneys apparently weren't zealous enough about vote fraud. So let's put that myth to rest, because it seems to me, sure, there's a mandate for GOP policy and politics, but at the heart of that mandate, there needs to lie some truth, and there is just a myth that a vote fraud that is animating this whole conversation.
EJ,
I think that's a really important point, because what you saw in some of these cases from the evidence we've seen so far is that some of these U.S. attorneys got into trouble because people somewhere in the administration, we don't know yet, seem to want them to bring cases close up to the election time, which, of course, is when a vote fraud case would have the maximum effect both in the newspapers mm-hmm. and potentially to intimidate voters. And as has been said correctly, a lot of these vote fraud cases tend to be directed against the registration of poor and minority voters who on balance vote Democratic. I think the other point is, people have said the administration has a right to name its own U.S. attorneys. That's absolutely true. Democratic administrations tend to name more Democrats. Republican administrations tend to name more Republicans. What you haven't seen before is a purge of this sort. U.S. attorneys have historically been very respected people, whichever party they're in. And it's the size of this purge. When people were dropped in the middle of a president's term, it was usually for very, very good cause, having to do with corruption or real malfeasance. In this case, you just don't have the evidence that a lot of the people they threw out were doing anything but a professional job. And so I think that's a big part of why this is so controversial.
Let's go to Victoria in Milford, Connecticut. Victoria, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm an attorney, and I am really wondering, I'm so appalled at this whole situation, but I'm wondering why no one is looking at the ethical responsibilities of an attorney. They have to represent their clients and do particular things. Why is no one speaking about pulling people's licenses or suspending their licenses or the
who are you thinking of, Victoria? What attorney, whose licenses do you want pulled here?
Well, I think you'd Gonzalez and all the way down. Anybody who's an attorney who is working at the Justice Department and not looking at the obligations that they have to the client, and the client being the public.
Mark Tushnet, Professor Tushnet, time to disbar the Attorney General of the United States?
I think that's premature for those people who think that something wrong has happened. The first thing that they would want would be to have a different Attorney General. There's still, I think, enough factual ambiguity to continue an investigation. You know, there's evidence here that lots of people will draw conclusions from, and those conclusions may be right. But there's also there's also things that we still need to know. So far, for example, nobody has taken responsibility for compiling the list of attorneys to be dismissed. Gonzalez says he doesn't remember. He says he did what the senior people in his department mm-hmm. advised him to do. McNulty says he didn't make up the list. Monica Goodling says she didn't make up the list. She wasn't the keeper of the kingdom. There are not many other people left who could have made up the list, and it would be helpful to find out from them whether they did or not.
Dahlia, are we getting closer to seeing where the strings lead here?
Well, I think one of the things that Monica Goodling actually did say yesterday, even though she sort of said it in code, was that Kyle Sampson was, in fact, the keeper of the list. I mean, she was fairly clear in saying this was his project. It was ongoing for a year and a half. You know, he was the guy who, you know, he, in his own testimony, you'll remember he called himself the aggregator, which is one of the all-time great passive nouns. But it seems to me that there's no question that she said, look, this was his baby. And she also said McNulty and Gonzalez, contrary to both of their claims, were involved in meetings and discussions. They were sort of overseeing this. So I do think this sort of the focus is narrowing. It's clear that this sort of weird cabal of what the word that Gonzalez keeps using is senior leadership of the Justice Department, whatever that means, it's closing in on Sampson as the actual doer, but with serious consultation from McNulty and Gonzalez.
Let's go to Dave in Ashland, Massachusetts. Dave, what do you see?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to just reiterate the point, I wasn't sure that you were going to get to it, about the voter fraud issue. I think there's an excellent resource on the web is the site Talking Points Memo, where they have documented can analyze this issue with respect to it being a plot on the part of Karl Rove or the White House in general as a way to solidify a permanent Republican majority, to disenfranchise, as some of your guests have already mentioned, Democratic voters, to the point that you could start to win those close elections in a lot of
closely matched districts. So using U.S. attorneys to raise the issue of voter fraud to scare people away from the polls, and the theory goes, tip the balance right there.
Right, exactly. And if you look at where a lot of these attorneys are, they happen to be in those swing states. I don't think that that's a coincidence that can be overlooked.
Not by accident, you say. Let's take a call from Macon, Georgia. Richard, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question really has to do with Monica Goodling herself. I see this administration as having pushed past politics and into ideology, and I cannot understand how a young attorney like Monica Goodling reached the position she reached and was part of the decision she was part of, except for the fact that she is from a university affiliated with Pat Roberts, which is Regents University.
Regent University School of Law. She's a grad there, right? And many of the grads from that school have come into this administration, but so what?
Well, it just seems like there's a preponderance of people with a certain ideology that reach levels of the government that we've not seen in the past.
Yeah, Mark Tushnet, what do you say to that? As a professor of law, does the origin of the legal staffers being brought in matter to you?
No, I want to put in at least a moderately good word for Regent University Law School here. I think there's a lot of sort of condescending elitism in the references to Regent as a religiously affiliated law school with a mission of educating lawyers in a particular kind of way. There's nothing wrong with that. The question is whether the people who come out are qualified as lawyers and how they think about the law. Now, maybe Ms. Goodling, you know, misbehaved or, you know, didn't do the right thing, but I don't think it's fair to attribute that to the fact that she went to Regent University Law School. It's also the case that, you know, people at her level, the government is full of assistants of that sort, young lawyers who have what are essentially administrative assistant roles. Think of the West Wing and how old the people on the West Wing were. She's not different from that in that kind of way. The only question is whether she did, you know, misbehaved or not. And as I say, with respect to the career attorneys, she's acknowledged that she did.
He has indeed. E.J. Dionne, what about the center of gravity here and whether it's been pushed off of our best traditions? Do you see self-correction underway here? Is it possible that we're losing our grip on that the ideal of the, you know, politically disinterested civil servant, or at least one who can set their politics aside to at least follow the letter of the law and the Constitution?
Well, I think we have lost some grip, and I think divided government does wonders for accountability, and that's what you're seeing, is you had a long period of time where there really were not very many accountability hearings for this government because you had unified Republican control. I want to applaud Professor Tushnet for trashing elitism. I totally agree with him on that point in terms of Regent University. But I think there's another question here, which is the balance between competence and ideology, between professionalism and ideology. My Washington Post colleague Rajiv Chandrasekaran wrote an excellent book on the early period in Iraq, where it appeared that in many cases when the administration had a choice between somebody who was a professional at dealing with what was on the ground in Iraq or a Republican advance man, they picked the person who was loyal. And so in an administration, you need a mix of loyalty and competence. And I think what's raised about this inner circle here in the Justice Department is, and I'm obviously not talking about Mr. Comey here, who is a real professional, but is how do you push the balance way too far toward party loyalty, where loyalty is so paramount that you lose track of a lot of other values? And I think there's evidence that that's what's happened here.
EJ, are we done with this? Is there more ammo for critics of the AG to pull out? Is Gonzalez going to take more blows, or is that it?
Well, no, I think he's going to stay for quite a while because I don't think the president wants a fight over a new attorney general. And in some sense, he's done his job, even at the risk of looking incompetent, by taking all the fire and keeping it away from the White House. Dahlia made an excellent point about there were only so many hands on this, so many hands in creating this
right.
mess. But we still don't know about the White House. And I think
and the firewall point. Holding for now. E.J. Dionne at the Brookings Institution. We've got to go. Mark Tushnet at Harvard Law School. Dahlia Lithwick with Slate. Thanks to all of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.